This is WJBC This Week.
I don't mean to be or act like a heartless person, but the majority of the people that are back there that say that they can't go to the shelters is because the shelters don't allow people with alcohol on their breath.
I'd rather make a tough decision today than put it off, you know, a year or 2 years or 3 years, when the decision not only will be more difficult, it'll be even less popular than it is right now.
Legislators realize that to target a single product as it relates to a complex issue like obesity, it's just misguided.
The administration has not come out and said what they're negotiating. It's been one of the most non-transparent negotiations we've seen, and with, frankly, one of the most important nations in the Middle East.
This is WJBC This Week. I'm Terry James. It's where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. On this week's program, a criminal justice professor reacts to the report of widespread racial profiling in Ferguson, Missouri. An author digs deep into Illinois' history of political corruption. An author looks at our fascination with vitamin supplements and whether the benefits match their claims. And on the heels of Ringling Brothers announcing that it's dropping its elephant acts, local zoo director Jay Tetzloff says zoo elephants are becoming scarce. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. A Justice Department report released this week showed a pattern of civil rights violations by police officers in Ferguson, Missouri, where unarmed black teenager Michael Brown was shot to death by a white officer last summer. It was found that police in the St. Louis suburb disproportionately stopped blacks without reasonable suspicion and arrested them without probable cause. Associate Professor of Criminal Justice at Illinois State University Michael Gizzi discussed the report with WJBC's Dan Swaney this week.
The story that I'm reading, it is not just prevalent. It is overwhelming. It's incredible what they found in this. Can we go through some of the things?
Sure.
For example,
sure. For example, 67% of the population of Ferguson is black or African American. In between 2012 and 14, 85% of all vehicle stops were of minorities. 93% of all arrests, people were black. 88% of cases where there was a use of force, the person used was black. Those jailed for more than 2 days, 95% were black. Now, to be honest, there's a lot of racial profiling data out in this country. We have a lot of data from the Illinois traffic stop studies that have been done now for a decade. And we see disparity in Illinois as well. But what you're seeing in Ferguson is at the extremes. There's a lot of data about the New York stop and frisk program that has finally come to an end. And there was data where it was gross disparities. But this data is really remarkable. It's not surprising that this became a flashpoint.
It goes even farther than that in the story that I looked at this morning. It said African Americans were 67% less likely to have their cases dismissed by a Ferguson municipal judge. So this goes beyond the police department down there. This is prevalent, it looks like, in all forms of the legal system. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, think about we had a prosecutor who did not want to indict, and he completely dominated and distorted the grand jury system. So that's not surprising. And I suspect the issues. I'm not an expert on St. Louis County, but it's from what I've been reading in the last 6 months, you know, this is a problem. These problems extend into the county as well. There were emails uncovered of, you know, blatant examples of racism within the department, within the city. It's disturbing, and you know, Ferguson provides us with an example of, you know, literally of systemic problems that illustrate that race is still an issue in this country, even though we don't want to admit that it is.
Absolutely. Well, the other side of the argument that I know is going to come to the table, it's going to say even though 67% of the Ferguson population is black and the numbers say that there were an inordinate amount of people who were arrested who were African-American down there, the argument that will come back from the other side is says, well, maybe they were just bad people and that's why the numbers were so high. Does it ever work out that way?
And that argument gets made all the time that, well, the reason why blacks get arrested and stopped at higher rates is because they're the ones causing problems.
Right.
The reality is there's so much data on racial profiling that just caused that puts that cast doubt on that. And one of the things that we see when we look at the traffic stop data reports from Illinois, for example, is that when we look at the people who are stopped and we look at the ratio of minorities being stopped to whites, and then when we look at the questions of when they actually find contraband, they find contraband more often with Caucasians or whites than they do with blacks across the board. I'll give you a different example, canine sniffs. The canines alert like 90% of the time when they do the search and when they do the sniff, and yet they find contraband far more often with whites than they do with blacks. And that's a different issue altogether, which would be an entirely different discussion. But my point is that, you know, there's plenty of data that would contradict the claims that, well, this is just because the bad people are the black people. That's just garbage.
The other thing that will be brought up is Eric Holder, being a pal of President Obama, working in his administration. He, of course, was going to lean this in one direction. Do you buy that argument?
No.
Yeah?
No. He's the chief legal officer of the United States. And if we're going to take that argument, then, you know, at face value, then it just cast doubt on just the legitimacy of everything. I refuse to accept that. We're talking a highly educated person. Yes, he's experienced racism, and he talked about and was criticized, but he still stands by talking about how he had to talk to his children about how their interactions will be with police. And, you know, a lot of black people have to do that, and that's sad. That doesn't mean all cops are racist. They're not. That doesn't mean that all, you know, all interactions are driven by race. But what it suggests is that there is a culture within policing that we need to seriously examine, and oftentimes we're not willing to.
Michael Gizzi from ISU is with us right now. One of the numbers that jumped out in the story that I read this morning, and this leads back directly to August of last year, blacks were disproportionately more likely to be cited for minor infractions. 95% of tickets for, quote, manner of walking in the roadway, essentially jaywalking, were against African Americans. Mm-hmm. Also, 94% of all failure to comply charges were filed against black people. That's what happened in August.
One of the things that we've seen in recent years, and I'm a professor of criminal justice. My background is as a political scientist. I'm not a criminologist. I don't study the causes of crime. But within criminology, one of the arguments that's been made for many years is what we call broken windows policing, and where we go after quality of life crime, and we go after minor crimes, minor offenses. And they, you know, the New York data has been so blatantly, it's been so overwhelming in pointing out that when we do that, we disproportionately target blacks and Hispanics, but mostly blacks. And, you know, that those are examples of disparity. And, you know, just plain and simple, those are examples of disparity. And people don't want to admit it, but I'm sorry, but I can't explain it away any other way than that. And we see this data time and time again. And it's supposedly, you know, we're going to go after these quality of life offenses, and then this will supposedly make things safer. But what it really does is it results in harassment of an entire class of citizens.
That was ISU Professor Michael Gizzi with our Dan Sweeney. Four of the last nine Illinois governors have spent time in prison. That's one reason why Illinois is often considered one of the most politically corrupt states in the country. Author Tom Gradel went about chronicling Illinois' history of politics on the wrong side of the law in his new book, Corrupt Illinois. He talked with WJBC Scott Laughlin and Colleen Reynolds this week.
What are some of the reasons Illinois is basically listed as the fourth most corrupt state?
Yeah, actually,
we're only fourth.
We figured it out as third, and the way that is figured out, and you know, it's very hard because no one really keeps great statistics. The Department of Justice keeps statistics in which they call public integrity or public corruption convictions. And they have raw totals of how many convictions in each state, and Illinois has the third most number. But that's only one indicator. That's the quality or lack of quality. Of the people that have gotten convicted, and you know, Illinois, four governors out of the last nine, 33 city of Chicago aldermen.
Yeah, but you know what? It's not just Chicago.
But two of them died before they could be prosecuted.
Yeah, it's not just Chicago, though. You talk about some downstate. One of my favorite stories is the Rita Crumwell,
yeah.
Crumwell from Dixon, who milked.
Dixon, all right, yeah.
$53.7 million over 22 years.
Right.
So what leads to this corruption? What is it about Illinois and its laws, its climate, its culture that allows for so much corruption?
It's primarily the culture. The laws are there, but they're not. There's not enough enforcement, and also there's a culture where people, little machines have formed, you know, around the state. I mean, it's not just everybody thinks of the Democratic machine in Cook County. But there's Republican machines in DuPage. There's other small machines. There used to be a machine in Kankakee. I mean, and the machine culture promotes and nourishes corruption, because basically what the machine corruption is, it gives favors to certain people and denies favors to other people. And in order to do that, you pretty much have to either commit crimes or behave very unethically and do things that most people would consider wrong. And also, the Democratic machine in Chicago, which has lasted way longer than major machines in other cities around the country, under the old Richard J. Daley, they perfected machine behavior and got away with murder. And at one time, they got away with everything close to murder. And at one time they controlled, you know, not only the mayor's office and the whole government of the city of Chicago, the government of Cook County, the court system. They dominated off and on. They dominated the state legislature, and off and on the Democratic machine in Chicago could elect its own candidate as governor. So they had, they were able to dominate politics and government, and therefore there's very any checks or balances that exist are wiped out, because nobody will say anything about what anybody else is doing, and they're all participating in it.
Well, so it's the culture. I hate to interrupt you, because we're running out of time. It's the culture, though, and this is what Rod Blagojevich was saying. Hey, what I'm doing has been done for years. What's the big deal?
Well, in his case, the big deal was he did it on telephone calls when the government was taping his telephone, and he should have known that he was being surveilled, because many of his top aides were under investigation, and he knew it. So he not only was doing what other people were doing, but he was doing it in one of the most stupid ways. and he had no compunctions about, you know, getting on the phone. And
all right, let's throw some names out here. We're going to throw some names out because we're running out of time.
Well, I want to ask you a bottom line question, you know, because for the most part, people can look at the city of Chicago and say, hey, you know what? It's a city that works. Stuff got done. Things got built. What, you know, in the end, what is the harm? And is it that we pay actually a corruption tax because of these projects that were
$500 million a year? Actually, and things did not get done in the city of Chicago. I mean, they got done in the downtown area. They got done, you know, every place that the mayor and his publicity teams wanted to talk about. But Chicago has an incredible number of deteriorating overpasses, roads, the potholes are not filled. They are filled downtown. The parks in the neighborhoods are not in that great of condition. The schools are most people say the schools are well, well below average. So we have a lot of things that aren't getting done, and the tax money is not only is the tax money being siphoned off, but the corruption undermines the spirit of the people and destroys their willingness to pay taxes because they see all the corruption around and they say, I don't want to, the money's just going to make these fat cats fatter. They're not seeing the results of the sacrifices that they're making as far as taxes go are not making their lives better, certainly not in the neighborhoods. I mean, if you go downtown Chicago, it's a beautiful, beautiful place, but it's a show place.
Do you believe, I was looking at another study that noted that in Illinois, for example, in 2013, the state spent about $935 more per person than neighboring Indiana. And they're basically saying a lot of that is tied to these higher cost construction projects that were kickbacks.
Yeah, we quote in our book, Corrupt Illinois, we quote a purchasing agent for the state of Illinois prison system who said that his experience was that about all of the contracts, state contracts, taken as a total, not that everyone is this way, but are inflated by at least 5% due to corruption. And that when you're dealing with billion-dollar budgets, that's a lot of money.
That was Corrupt Illinois author Tom Graydell with Scott and Colleen. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. We assume that vitamin supplements are good, but how much of a good thing is bad? And do we even know that these supplements are good in the first place? Journalist Catherine Price studied the wild and largely unregulated world of vitamins and wrote a book about it called Vitamania, Our Obsessive Quest for Nutritional Perfection. And she talked with WJBC's Steve Fast this week.
We know that deficiencies are bad, but how much of those chemicals do we really know about as far as what we need to be healthy?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. It's something I didn't realize before I started looking into the book, is that, I assumed, like you, that there must be these set goals that some mysterious expert knew and we just needed to hit in order to be healthy. And in reality, the whole concept of the recommended dietary allowances, the RDAs you see on food labels, that's a work in progress, and it's certainly not done. And so, yeah, you have lots of challenges facing these researchers, ranging from the fact that we don't really know what vitamins do in our bodies, like they have more purposes than just preventing deficiency diseases, to all these individual variabilities between us. So, my needs may be different from your needs, and that might be because of our genetics, or it might be because one of us smokes and the other one doesn't, or one of us is older than the other, or one of us has like a digestive problem that prevents us from absorbing nutrients properly. And there are all these different variables that come into play that make it nearly impossible to actually give personalized recommendations for how much of each of these you need.
So how did the recommended daily allowance become something that is ubiquitous with half of the products that you hear advertised?
Well, recommended dietary allowances have been required to be part of the food label since the 90s. And so pretty much all packaged foods will have these on their backs to try to help people gauge the sufficiency of their diet. But one thing I found fascinating that is really not well known, I don't think, is that when you look at the back of a food or a supplement facts panel, the stuff that will say the calories and the percent of the daily value of various vitamins that one serving contains, what they don't let you know is that the basis for the vitamin calculation, so the basis that they use to do those percentages of the daily values, are not based on the most up-to-date recommendations from the Institute of Medicine. They're actually based on the recommendations from 1968 for the most part. And so when you look at your multivitamin or your breakfast cereal and you feel really self-congratulating congratulatory because it says it's 100% of all these various things. So that 100% is actually being calculated off of really outdated recommendations.
So, for instance, you might see an ad that says, the latest studies show that if you increase your fiber intake, that's good for you and you won't get cancer. So use this product, which has the recommended dietary allowance from research that was conducted 4 decades before that study.
Well, it gets a little confusing because it's more like the official recommendations, the RDAs on food labels and supplement labels. Those are calculated off as outdated information. But then what you're talking about is like every time you turn on the news and you see the latest study telling you that the death-defying effects of fiber or vitamin D or whatever. And that's kind of a different thing where that is the latest research, but it's probably just one study or two studies or a study that was done in mice or something like that. It's not actually been established to be scientific truth. The recommendations, when you make recommendations for the country, regardless of whether they're 1968 or now, you have to be very conservative because you need to make sure it's really based on stuff that pretty much all scientists will agree that the substance actually does. But, you know, like a newspaper or a magazine doesn't have that limitation in terms of publishing the news of a new study. So the public gets all of this very preliminary science, and then we get tempted to change what we eat based on that.
We're talking with journalist Catherine Price. Her new book, Vitamania, looks at our intake of vitamins and the supplement industry. Catherine, we get a lot of our vitamin intake from foods that are, as the ad copy says, fortified with vitamins and minerals. Where would most Americans be without added supplements?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question that, you know, came to me at some point when I was writing the book. I was like, how much of our daily vitamin intake is actually coming from these man-made additions? And there's a very interesting 2011 study in the Journal of Nutrition saying that actually a significant percentage of Americans' intake of most vitamins comes from synthetic sources, and that means man-made vitamins that are being added to our food, like vitamin D in milk or the vitamins in breakfast cereal. You know, and it's not to say that there's anything inherently wrong with man-made vitamins, but what I found really interesting is that when you think about how high these percentages are, you realize that they're not just kind of helping us. We're actually dependent on these vitamins that are being added to our food in order to prevent deficiencies. And that, I think, is a reflection of the nutritional quality or lack thereof of some of the base foods of the American diet, that if we didn't add vitamins to them, we might actually put ourselves at risk of deficiency.
Is there a big difference in the vitamins that a person gets naturally from something like spinach as opposed to that same vitamin created synthetically in a lab that you'd get from breakfast cereal or some other fortified product that's processed?
You know, it depends on the vitamin. There's no one, you know, this is good, this is bad answer. There's some vitamins that we absorb better from food. There are some that are basically the same, and then there's some, to use your spinach in that example, some like folic acid, which actually is easier for our bodies to absorb when it comes in the synthetic form. So you can't really make a judgment call on that. What you can say, though, is that when you have a vitamin in a food that naturally contains it, you've got an awful lot of stuff besides the vitamin that may be beneficial for your health that is not put into fortified products or supplements. So there's a lot more in an orange, for example, than vitamin C, but all those other compounds are not being put into your breakfast cereal.
So what kind of quality control does the supplement industry, do they have to guarantee that there are X amount of milligrams of the things that they say are in a pill?
Technically, there are something called good manufacturing practices. These were rolled out fully in 2010. And the purpose of these, they're a set of rules that are supposed to make sure that when you pick up a bottle, a supplement bottle, and you look at the ingredients, the bottle actually contains what the label says. Again, not testing to see if it does what it says or if it is safe, but just that it contains what it says. So it's great that these GMPs have been rolled out, the good manufacturing practices, but there are still huge problems with compliance. And the last figures I've heard are that when the FDA is doing these inspections, they found up to 70% of the facilities they inspect still have problems with GMPs with an average of 7 violations each. So it's a work in progress. It's definitely something to be concerned about.
Is there a concern for people that are taking supplements that they're getting too much of something? As we mentioned earlier, there are those recommended allowances, but there's not a consensus on really how that affects an individual. What are the risks of supplementing your diet when you might not need it?
Well, if you're talking about dietary supplements as the much broader category of these like 85,000 products you can get at GNCs and stuff, I don't know what the risks are because I don't know what's in those products, and really no one can tell you for sure. So I would say that those you should be cautious of even at low doses, and there are no RDAs for herbs and things like that even. For vitamins themselves, yeah.
That was journalist and author Catherine Price with WJBC's Steve Fast. Well, elephants will soon vanish from the greatest show on earth. Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus announced this week it will drop its elephant acts by 2018, bowing to pressure from animal rights groups. Circus officials said it was not an easy decision, but they believe it's in the best interest of the company, the elephants, and their customers. Miller Park Zoo director Jay Tetzloff says elephants are becoming an endangered species at zoos. He talked with WJBC's Susan Saunders this week.
Jay, what's been your interaction with elephants in your zoo life?
I've worked at two zoos that have had elephants. I've never worked with them specifically myself. Actually, my second paid job, I got to bring in the elephants at night. That was an interesting... It was very interesting because they were ready to come in because all the food was inside when you opened the door.
So you had to just get out of the way so you didn't get trampled?
Well, I was far enough away, obviously, that I didn't have to worry about them. But, I don't really consider myself an elephant fan, but it's another animal that is, it's high profile, mega mammal. People know what they are.
They're one of the most popular exhibits at a zoo when you have elephants, correct?
Yeah, and they're disappearing from zoos. Right now, there is no elephants in a zoo in Illinois.
Wow.
There's zero.
When we went through the pluses and minuses of the master plan, I thought elephants were like on the top of the wish list, and everybody immediately answered, not enough room.
Yeah. If we had elephants, we would have zero else.
Right.
We'd have nothing else.
Because it takes so much space.
They
but
need
at least
that, much
that,
space.
That was the response from the public.
Yep.
People like to see elephants.
Sure.
So are you in the side of... elephants are being abused when they're being used in circuses and live performances, or are you just happy to get to see elephants?
I try to decide on the side of, I believe that if you have animals at your facility and are trained, and the circus folks are definitely trained, they're definitely animal trainers, that they are going to take care of those animals in the right way, have good animal welfare, until you prove me otherwise. So I've been to a circus that had elephants. I did not see any abuse. All the animals looked good. I didn't see any issues with the elephants. They looked healthy. And in some cases, for example, here in central Illinois, if a circus came here, that's your only chance to see elephants.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not a bad thing.
But they have to do transportation of those.
The hard part is, it's not a ideal situation because you're hauling them all over the place, from 2 or 3 days in a row. To get to destination A to B. So it's certainly not ideal. I hope when they, when they remove these elephants that they might put some into the breeding situations if they're old enough or young enough, I should say, so that we have more elephants at zoos because there's not enough elephants right now to go around for the folks who want to have, a herd of 8 or 9 elephants.
I'm feeling guilty that I rode on an elephant at a zoo for a special occasion in Chicago when I was a child. And I loved it, and I fell in love with elephants and felt their power and their majesty and felt so privileged to have that moment with an elephant. But now I feel bad. But is it possible that elephants like human interaction?
You shouldn't feel bad because that individual elephant, its job was to get you engaged, which you're still talking about it, so you did. It worked. That's why zoos have petting yards. They're some will say, well, they're just goats. But sometimes that's the only animal contact they come across. And you can't get engaged by riding the tiger. You can do that once.
And then you never get to tell the tale.
And you're way more engaged than you want to be. There's no going back on that one. But, that's what the role of a zoo is to get people engaged and want to save those animals. Sometimes the one animal is strictly the ambassador for the rest of its species. So if you remember it.
I do, very strongly. I still remember what the elephant smelled like.
Yeah, so it made a difference. And so that's what zoos are trying to do every day. So I can't say I'm sad to say they're not doing elephants anymore. But I hope that that message still gets out and people still get engaged. Because a lot of animals, an elephant's a great example. If you save elephants and want to save elephants in Africa, you're going to save many, many more species because of that land that elephants use is used by so many other species.
That was Miller Park Zoo Director Jay Tetzloff with our Susan Saunders. This Week in News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Week in News. 10th City, the area where more than a dozen of Bloomington's homeless are currently calling home, is expected to be cleared out this weekend. Carl Thomas owns the property located behind McDonald's on West Market Street. He says the homeless staying there are trespassers.
In the last probably 5 years, I've probably had them removed two or three different times. It's county property. So the last time we had people leave, the county sheriff came down to have them removed.
Thomas says many of the homeless drink alcohol, which is why they can't get into a shelter. Most won't let you in if you smell of alcohol. A 25-year-old Bloomington woman who concealed a murder in 2013 has been sentenced to 18 years in prison. A Woodford County judge sentenced Vyshawn Mills. She pleaded guilty in January to concealing the homicide in the death of 74-year-old Oakley Mitchell. The rural Secor man's remains were found in his home and in the Mackinac River. Mills had been Mitchell's caretaker. Mills' boyfriend, Rayshon Johnson, was previously sentenced to 50 years in prison for the murder. Bloomington State Senator Jason Berrickman says Governor Rauner's proposal to freeze property taxes for 2 years is just one piece of a puzzle that's intended to boost Illinois' economy.
You have to look at this holistically. And if a local unit of government is given more flexibility, is given less mandates, then there's not such a demand locally for those tax dollars.
Rauner also wants local governments to be allowed to freeze property taxes. Berrickman says those taxing bodies could do that if the state reduced mandates and if local government agencies cut costs through consolidation. Mitsubishi Motors experienced a 26% increase in sales last month compared to February 2014. Spokesman Dan Irvin says it was a strong month.
February is usually a pretty good month. It was good this year for the entire auto industry.
Irvin says an extra weekend in February helped sales from a technical standpoint. He says it was also a good month for the local Mitsubishi dealer.
When you look at all the big cities and big markets around the country, O'Brien Mitsubishi here in Bloomington Normal was in the top 10 again this month.
The locally produced Outlander Sport saw a 2% increase in sales last month. Sales in 2015 are up over 29% compared to the first 2 months of 2014. The idea of changing the way the state pays for schools is again knocking around the state house. Dave Dahl has more.
Senate Bill 1, sponsored by State Senator Andy Menar, would allocate money more based on need than the formula used now in 1997 model. He takes a question from State Representative David McSweeney.
To fully optimize your new formula, what type of increase would you be looking at for fiscal year 16?
To answer your question, I'm not prepared to tell you what it is. But to me, the more important conversation is how can we spend the money we have better? And better means how do we get better results from the money we have today?
One change from last year's version of this bill is a consideration of regional differences in the cost of living. Dave Dahl, WJBC and WJBC.com.
Along with passing the next fiscal year budget this week, WJBC's Adam Stasinski reports Normal's Town Council also approved a new 4% gallon local gas tax and a higher garbage fee.
The new fee will be $18 instead of $12 per month. Councilman Chuck Scott says he appreciates how the new budget was structured.
What I appreciate the most of what they did in putting together this this budget is that they didn't make cuts around the edges. Rather, they looked at all programs that are mission critical, and they provided us with a plan that helps us to achieve our collective goals.
Many councilmen say they realize new taxes and increased fees are not popular decisions, but it's what needs to be done to continue offering the services Normal has. Adam Stasinski, WJBC and WJBC.com.
Thank you, Adam. The town of Normal has withdrawn a proposed intergovernmental agreement to share the cost of electronics recycling. The agreement would have been between the town, Bloomington, and McLean County. Normal City Manager Mark Peterson says the agreement essentially became unnecessary at this time.
We found out a couple of weeks ago that our recycling contractor had obtained manufacturing contracts that would allow them to handle our e-waste recycling. They would allow them to process those for free.
Peterson says this will only be the case until the end of the current contract in October. The three entities will meet again around August and will be making a decision if the intergovernmental agreement is still the best option. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu struck back against criticism that his speech to Congress didn't offer any real alternatives to a nuclear agreement the U.S. is negotiating with Iran. Congressman Adam Kinzinger tells Fox News there was a viable alternative if Iran asks for demands before dismantling its nuclear program.
That's when we should have said, okay, well, look, obviously you're not ready to negotiate if you think you can come to the table with demands. You cannot. So the sanctions are going to get tighter. You call us when you're ready to negotiate.
President Obama did not attend the speech, but did read a transcript and criticized Netanyahu for condemning the deal without offering an alternative. Netanyahu says he made his alternative clear: toughen sanctions against the Islamic Republic until it agrees to abandon its nuclear ambitions. The money from a proposed soda tax in Illinois would go to public health initiatives. As Dave Dahl reports, there's a case against it.
Jim Soaring of the Illinois Beverage Association and Alyssa Bassler of the Illinois Alliance to Prevent Obesity are on opposite sides.
Consumers want government to stay out of their grocery cart. Giving people information, showing folks what the impact of the products they eat and drink have on their overall health and wellness is the proven path. And trying to make change through tax policy just isn't effective.
No choices are being taken away from anyone. Everyone would still be free to purchase whatever drinks that they wanted.
The proposal for a penny per ounce tax on sugary drinks fizzled out last year. The governor suggests there's even less reason to wet your whistle for any kind of tax increase now. At the Capitol, Dave Dahl, WJBC and WJBC.com.
More than 100 students at Normal Community High School walked out of class in protest of the park exam Friday. I had a chance to talk with the students at the morning rally. Here's the report that I filed. The new exam is expected to take 11 hours in all, and many students said they did not want to be represented by a number. Brianna Oldenburg joined the march.
It takes out of learning from the classroom. We need to be in the classroom more than we need to be in the testing room.
The test evaluates Common Core standards adopted by the state.
I don't feel like the material on the test shows how much we actually know. I feel like it only shows like a snippet of what we've been taught.
Some students have vowed to boycott the test next week. Terry James, WJBC, and WJBC.com. A candidate forum was held this week for the upcoming elections on April 7th. First, we start with Bloomington. Right-to-work zones do not have the support of either candidate, hoping to be Bloomington's Ward 8 alderman. More from WJBC's Adam Stasinski.
Alton Franklin says he's always been a big supporter of unions.
My parents divorced when I was 15 years old. At the ripe old age of 16, I was helping Mama. I went to work as a grocery bagger, joined RCIA Local 1013, and a finer group of folks I never knew in my life.
Incumbent Diana Howman says she would oppose any effort to establish a right-to-work zone in Bloomington.
I view such attempts as an effort to reduce or eliminate the power of collective bargaining, and I would consider right-to-work zones to be both bad for our economy and also for our community as a whole.
Both spoke at a candidate forum held at Laborers Local 362 Hall last night. Adam Stasinski, WJBC and WJBC.com.
In Ward 4, Amelia Burgess takes on Jeremy Kelly. David Sage is unopposed in Ward 2. Karen Schmidt is unopposed in Ward 6. Both candidates vying for Bloomington's Ward 5 alderman position in the April election believe quality of life is important. Lupe Diaz believes good infrastructure and low taxes are what creates a high quality of life.
Instead of expanding the zoo and building hotels, we need to accelerate the repairs to our streets and sewers, which will provide good-paying middle-class jobs.
Incumbent Johnny Painter says the cities with high quality of life have higher bond ratings.
It also encourages new business startups because people want to live and work in nice communities, and young people want to stay in communities that have a lot to offer them.
All four candidates for Normal Town Council have varying views on what a high quality of life is. Incumbent Jeff Fritzen believes it means having essential city services.
A lot of times it gets attached simply to parks or the things that are considered extras, but it starts with the essential services.
Another incumbent, Chuck Scott, says quality of life is based on a person's one definition.
It's important for all residents to have fair wages and to have open opportunities to pursue their dreams and live the quality of life that they desire.
Challenger Kathleen Loren says quality of life is an economic engine.
A source to fuel and sustain growth in a community and to set us apart from other communities.
R.C. McBride, also a challenger, says quality of life is the reason he's running for town council.
I have a great passion for quality of life. I know we've heard the term model, and I really do feel that Normal is already very much a model community for the state of Illinois.
Three of the four candidates will be elected in April. And four four-year terms on Unit 5's Board of Education are up for election in April. Two incumbents running for re-election, Denise Schuster and Michael Trask, agree the number one issue facing public education is funding. Schuster says public is the key word there.
We're going to need to work with everyone who can participate in bringing ideas on how to fairly do more with less and on creative solutions to the challenges that we face.
Trask says Unit 5 is facing a $1.5 to $2.5 million deficit.
Those are alarming numbers that we as a district are going to have to make some decisions in the near future, and we need to fight for public education.
Four challengers are also seeking a seat on the school board. A single two-year term seat is being sought only by incumbent Gail Ann Briggs. Up next, the week to come, this is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. It's time to take a look ahead at the week to come. Bloomington City Council meets on Monday night. On Tuesday, three Bloomington aldermen will hold a meeting at the Lincoln Leisure Center to discuss city budget priorities with the public. On Wednesday, the city will hold a public meeting at Pepperidge Elementary to discuss the Fox Creek Road Bridge replacement. On Thursday night, the Women's Missouri Valley Conference basketball tournament gets underway in St. Charles, Missouri. The Redbirds will play that night. And on Friday, Nicholas Compton of Colfax will be sentenced on first-degree murder charges for the beating death of an infant, Robbie Kramer, who was killed in March of 2013. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC podcast page. Thanks for listening. I'm Terry James.